Hello everyone, and welcome to minute 77 of season 10 of Movie Around Minute, the Daily Podcast, where we hijack our way through the 1974 action thriller, The Taking of Pelham 123, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Jim O'Kane of the Captain America Minute, at the upcoming Captain America Minute. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Great to be here, Rob. I love being subterranean with you on these episodes. So this will be another great time in the bowels of Manhattan.
Well, we get stuff above and below.
Yes, we're multi-level.
Yeah, and multi-location. I mean, we keep jumping locations all around. As we talked about yesterday, even the conversations between the characters. Someone can be underground. They're talking to someone overground, or they're talking to somebody in a different office, in a different location, just jumping back and forth, but it's just done really well. So minute 77 begins with Garber listening intently to Daniel's idea and ends with Green starting to wonder a little bit about Garber. So we ended things yesterday on a cliffhanger where Inspector Daniels says, "I just had a terrible thought." And Garber responds, and with a very intense look. He doesn't even have to even say anything to him, And then Daniels goes, "Suppose they're not on the train. What if they set the throttle and jumped off? While we're chasing the train, they're sneaking out of an emergency exit somewhere behind us." And I mean, I like the way that Garber responds here, because he's sort of the way that he's responding is he's not trying to belittle Inspector Daniels, because here is someone who's high up. I think we talked about it a few weeks ago. The inspector is like the third highest level below, like the I think he's maybe I think you have the borough chief and then the assistant borough chief and then inspector, something like that. So this someone's pretty high up. So he's giving him a little, he's giving him the honor that's due him by not saying that's a stupid idea. Because, the way that Garber responds, he goes, "Ingenious, sir. Except for one thing. It's impossible." So, it's sort of like a kiss-ass type of response, which I wouldn't necessarily expect from Garber. To me, that's one of the few lines in this movie that when Garber says it, you don't really believe that he means it. By the way that he's, he's just putting a face to it, I guess.
Yeah, it's like when you watch Family Feud and the one family member says something dumb, and everybody else in the family goes, good answer," and claps. It's just
that's true.
He's trying to let him. I think he's trying to let him down easy about no, you can't do that, but he's saying it in the safest way possible, with all due respect.
That's right. With all due respect, no. And then Daniels goes, "Why?" And he goes, "Well, a little gizmo known as a dead man's feature. It was built into the control handle in case the motorman should ever drop dead. The handle has to have a man's hand pressing down on it hard at all times. Otherwise, the thing won't work. The train stops cold." Ah, I see. And even by the way that Garber explains things to him, Daniels basically feels like an idiot at this point by the way that it was just explained to him. He goes, I see. He goes, "Nice try, though." And then Garber says, "I'll give him a call in case you're still worried about it." So, again, I like the interaction, even if it is sort of like a kiss-up type of answer with the way that he does it. And obviously this is not meant for Daniels. This is meant for us to explain to us the whole idea of this, dead man switch type of thing. Okay. Are you familiar with the idea of a dead man switch?
Not only am I familiar, I have actually used one twice.
Ooh.
And I wasn't supposed to, but the, long ago, back when the earth was cooling, when I was a kid, I used to live near the Harlem division of the Penn Central Railroad which was the MTA, part of what runs the subway system and the commuter rail in New York and Connecticut. And anyway, their railroad system has different lines: the Harlem line, the Hudson line, the New Haven line. I lived in the middle one, the Harlem line, and at the end of the line was Brewster, New York. Now that's regular commuter service went to Brewster. It continued north of Brewster to a town called Dover Plains. And they did have passenger service there, but it's very small passenger service. So what they would use, rather than running a huge train with lots of cars, they used something called a Bud. The Bud Company of Philadelphia built a single passenger car, combination passenger car and locomotive, called the Bud RDC, or rail diesel car. And it was basically a one car passenger train. And at each end of the train was the controller, similar to the motorman's perch here in the subway. And you'd have a throttle and a brake. And to the right of the brake was a pedal on the floor, and that was the dead man switch. The only way you could move the throttle would be to hold the dead man's. It's kind of like in modern cars, if you have to step on the brake to start the car, it's similar to that. You have to step on the dead man switch and hold it down to keep the train running. Otherwise, it goes into neutral. And so you'd push down on the dead man switch with your foot and then move the throttle forward. And you had to keep your foot on the dead man switch. He's long since passed, so I can tell the story. Mr. Fallon, who was a motorman on the RDC, going to Dover Plains, he would sometimes let me, I was about 14 or 15, he would let me try out the throttle
Oh,
on a
you should be
train going north.
fired.
Yeah, well, he's beyond being fired. So so he would let me, and often we were the only two people on the train. They had the train, the train to run even if there were no people on them. So we'd take the train north to Dover Plains, and I'd get to drive it through the upper reaches of Dutchess County. And you really did have to keep your foot on that switch. Now, Mr. Fallon never used it, but underneath the seat was a cinder block, and you could. If one needed to, one could put the cinder block on top of the dead man switch, and that would totally defeat the purpose of the switch. He never used it. I never used it on there, but it is possible to defeat a dead man switch.
Well, as we will find out
In
later this week.
yes. So I think the worst thing you can say is in a movie, if somebody says it's impossible, or if somebody says nothing can go wrong, the exact opposite is true. But I do not know. I don't know. I'm sure you're going to tell us, but I don't know how long a dead man switch has been around. And it is a great safety feature, especially when you're driving a multi-ton vehicle over steel rails.
Oh, wow. So you see, I never would have. Let's put it this way: if I were to think about all of my guests, the one person who possibly, would have had a story about this, I would have guessed it was you, but I didn't believe that you would have had a story. So,
Oh well, that was, and that's my only story about Dead Man's Switch. I'm glad I could pull it out in time.
yeah, that's true. Oh wow, interesting. So basically, they decided to start implementing the idea of some sort of dead man switch in the early 20th century. There was a huge crash in 1918 on the Malbone Street wreck on the Brooklyn Rapid Transit, and they decided after this wreck that they needed a way in order to have devices inside trains in order to halt them in the case of an operator becoming somewhat disabled. This didn't happen. The crash didn't happen because of that, but it gave people the idea that they needed to do that. Now, how many times do you think over the last 107 years has the Manhattan Transit Authority needed to actually use the dead man switch feature successfully? Let's put it that way. What
I'll
would
go
be your
with
guess?
three. I'll go with three.
And you would be right. You'd be
Oh,
right.
wow.
Yeah, you see, Jim,
Okay.
you know your dead man switch information. So yes,
Oh,
there
okay.
was
I got there,
it
but there's been three, and over what time period?
since 1918, there have been
Wow.
only three instances where they needed to use a dead man switch. In a real situation, I guess, where the driver became incapacitated. In 1927, in 1940, and in 2010. Those are the only times that was needed, which is pretty interesting. That
Yeah.
that's the only time that it was needed. My guess,
Sounds like
I would have guessed a lot more
they,
than that.
yeah, it sounds like they hire pretty healthy motormen, I guess.
I guess so. Or someone felt something coming on and turned off the train,
Yeah.
before he had his heart attack. I don't
Wow.
know. I mean, the one that happened on it happened on, I think, May, or it's in the newspaper on May 7th, 2010, which means that it probably was the day before, May 6th. Where they have an article in the New York Times, which I can't read the whole article because I don't pay for the New York Times. But the title of the article is "Not the First Time the Dead Man Switch Did Its Job." So, that makes it pretty interesting, the whole idea. Now, they have the idea of dead man switches in other things besides trains. Okay, they have it in different type of treadmills, in order to make sure that if someone falls off or walks away without turning off the treadmill, so it'll turn it off, not necessarily for security reasons. They're not concerned that the treadmill is gonna cause an accident. They're just, I guess it's the idea of having to save money in order for that. It's not gonna work. In computers, they have it a lot because there are with information security and stuff like that, where computers can be turned off if certain things are separated from them and stuff like that. It's like a kill cord, stuff like that. Now, I'm aware of the fact that you are a big fan of NASA. Do you know that they have the same idea in spacecraft?
I was not aware. I guess they have their hand. I know in the Apollo days, you had to have their hand on the abort switch, but I'm not sure if that would turn off the engines if you let go of the abort switch. But there is there.
Okay,
In what sense? How do they do it?
I'm going to explain it. So, many
Okay.
spacecraft use a form of a dead man switch to guard against command system failures. They have a timer that is established that is normally reset by the receipt of any valid command, including one whose sole function is to reset the timer. If the timer expires, the spacecraft enters a command loss algorithm that cycles through a predefined sequence of hardware or software modes, such as a selection of a backup command receiver, until a valid command is received. The spacecraft may also enter a safe mode to protect itself while waiting for further commands. Okay.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see how.
Sorry.
I see how
I
they're
mean,
expressing it.
it has similarity to a dead man switch and this type of device. It you can't really define it as a dead man switch because its aim is to recover from a hardware failure rather than the absence of a human operator.
Right.
It's usually called a watchdog timer, and they use it quite often when you're dealing with nuclear powered control systems, and therefore it's similar to the idea of a dead man switch that it won't cause a complete it won't cause the spacecraft to turn off when there's a problem like
Yeah.
this. And the only there was only one time where a spacecraft, and this one was an unmanned spacecraft, which it they needed to use this timer in order for it to it had a command receiver failure with a common loss timer. I know that this is a complete shot in the dark, but you have any idea what unmanned, what famous unmanned spaceship actually had this occur?
I'm gonna guess it's one of the Voyagers, either Voyager 1 or 2.
Jim, unbelievable. It's Voyager 2.
Okay.
Interesting, interesting.
Wow. Well, I have to say that the most common one that I know of in terms of dead man switches are lawnmowers. I mean, I've got a dead man
Yes.
switch on my lawnmower. You can't if you let go of the handle and the motor turns off instantly. So it's better losing power than losing a foot.
That's right. They have them. They have them on chainsaws also. Those are known as dead man handles, I guess you
Yeah.
could say.
I have 10 toes because of that.
That's a good thing. That's a good thing.
Yes.
Right. So they have freight elevators, lawnmowers, tractors, personal watercraft, outboard motors, chainsaws, snowblowers, treadmills, snowmobiles, amusement rides, and medical imaging devices. They all have some sort of built-in feature that will turn it off. In connection to yesterday's episode, they all have some sort of fail-safe
Yes.
along the way. But there's another use of the term dead man switch, which is used in when someone's trying to blackmail someone else. Are you familiar
Oh,
with that
okay,
one?
yeah. If something happens to me, then my lawyer is getting an envelope.
That's right.
Yes.
That's right. It's some sort of file will be released of damaging material if something happens to me or my family or whatever it is. That type of thing.
Yes, more honored on episodes of Columbo,
Yes.
and probably in real life.
Well, because most people probably don't think of doing that.
Yeah.
We'll have to see how that fits in. Right. So, oh wow, here I actually do have the full article. I was able to find a copy of the full article that I was talking about from
Hooray.
so on April 27th, 2010, a motorman on the G train apparently suffered a fatal heart attack at the controls, activating the so-called dead man's feature, which stops the train when the motorman takes his hand off the controller. At the time, several rail buffs and subway experts told us they had never known before heard of a case where the dead man's feature actually kicked in. But the Manhattan Borough historian Michael Misciani said that didn't sound right. His diligent search turned up two instances in which the dead man's feature saved the day. On January 12th, 1940, the Times reported the motorman on an IRT Express on the Lexington Avenue line was suddenly taken ill and collapsed as it was passing underneath 56th Street, while the operator, P. Macchiaroli, may have suffered a cerebral hemorrhage. The riders were spared anything worse than a shaking and a delay of 28 minutes. The earlier case in 1927 was considerably more mysterious. At 8:10 a.m. on August 16th, 1927, which was a Tuesday, Robert Bacon, the motorman of what is now the number 3 line, was found dazed on the floor of his cab by the conductor when the train came to a halt at 142nd Street and Lenox Avenue. There was a deep cut over his eye, the Times wrote, and he was unable to explain his condition. Mr. Bacon, 35, was said to have fractured his skull. While the cause of his injuries remained unclear, the Times was able to rule out labor strife. Okay.
Wow.
So I guess the one in 2010 was the only one that was fatal. But, the comments actually are pretty funny. Someone says, we need one that stops the train when the motorman starts texting. And then someone mentioned here that it happened on the in the French Connection. So I'm trying to remember if that happened then. I mean, it didn't happen in Speed when when they shot the motorman there. And then it actually got faster.
Yeah.
But
Yeah. Well, it depends on what services the script best.
exactly. Actually, what's funny is someone said it happened in the French Connection, and then someone responds and says, "I think you're talking about the taking of Pelham 123." And then someone responds and I think and says, "In the French Connection, the motorman is shot by the frog heroin dealer who dies on the dead man switch, causing the train to crash. In the taking of Pelham 123, there's no conductor and the train doesn't end up crashing." Oh, come on, spoiler. They're giving away spoiler to the New York Times.
Yeah, we're too far down the movie for that.
Exactly. So yeah, it's an interesting idea that someone actually thought of something like the Dead Man's Feature for a train. So yeah, I like the way they do that. So at this point, Garber then tries to contact Pelham once again. He goes, "Pelham 123, Pelham 123, what's going on down there? The tracks aren't cleared yet. How come you're moving?" And then Blue responds and goes, "We're moving because we're trying to put some distance between us and all those policemen you've got hidden in that tunnel back there." And then Garber says, "Well, if you keep moving, you're going to run into a lot of red signals. I don't want you to blame us for it." He goes, "I won't blame you for anything. Just let us know when you've cleared the track." "Okay, signing off." And at that point, Green turns to Blue and says, "You think he's able to figure anything out? I mean, all those questions." I actually like the fact that it's Green who's thinking of something like this, because Blue is the one who really, he seems like the one who knows every little intricate piece of what it is that you're doing here. And I sometimes you need someone to be looking from the outside in to be able to see things that when you're on the inside, you're not necessarily going to see.
Yeah, I mean, keeping away from was it no plan survives contact with the enemy? I think you need somebody else that can say, well, what about this or what about that? And I think that's where
Exactly.
he's at. It's like maybe he's thinking the way we're thinking. They're not exactly novices at understanding how subways work.
So I like the way that they do that. And as Green is talking, that's where the minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to mention about this particular minute?
Just that when you're looking at, I thought it was interesting when you're looking at the over the head shot or behind the shot from behind of Balsam and Shaw looking out the window. There's a glass window there looking out at the subway rails up ahead. But when they do the reverse shot, so you're looking at them face on, there's no window because it would just they would look kind of they'd be sh shooting through a very dirty window. So it's interesting how they remove the glass at the front of the motor at the front of the motorman's cabin. I guess we're not supposed to notice those kind of. It's like when they take the rear view mirror off of cars when you're seeing somebody driving in a car. There's no rear view mirror hanging on the windshield. So it's a conceit of film that we're not supposed to notice these things. But of course, when you're watching the movie frame by frame like we do, then you
Right.
go, oh yeah,
And
there it is.
you got to make sure that you don't put your hand through the
Yeah.
open window area.
Exactly, yeah.
Oops. Yeah, that type of thing. All right, that's great. So every Tuesday we have a segment called Blues Day Tuesday, where my guests will give their top five Robert Shaw performances. So why don't you once again start with your number five and work your way up?
Oh, my number five. Yes. It's funny. I don't think I don't maybe he has been, but I have never seen Robert Shaw in a non-action movie. So all of mine are action films. Number five, I remember seeing this in the theater, and it's Robert Shaw teamed up with Crazy Bruce Dern, Black Sunday, which is one of my favorite films. Thomas Harris knows how to write. I mean, Silence of the Lambs and all that, but get crazy Bruce Dern being one of his absolute craziest, and Robert Shaw being the Mossad agent who knows how to get who knows what's going on. He's kind of the he and he's a good guy in this one. So it's I'm and a great film. I mean, this was he had a very busy period in the
In the
70s
late
there,
70s,
and
yeah.
going with the number four, I'd go with his I don't want to say sequel to Jaws, but The Deep would be my number four with Jacqueline Bisset, who was my final guest on the Airport Minute back when I did that podcast. But that was gosh, what a great unforgettable movie, mostly because of Jacqueline Bisset and her t-shirt scuba diving. He does a great job in that. I wish he would pick an accent in that movie because it seemed like he was trying out the entire British Isles, and maybe possibly Jamaica for the different accents that Robert Shaw was trying in it.
Yeah.
Number three, I'm sure this people move the top three around, but I'm going to go with Jaws as my number three. He's really not the star of that movie. He's not the I mean he's one of the stars, but I think Roy Scheider kind of takes the lead as the organizing sensibility in that. But he's great as the supporting actor in that film. And it's probably the one that most people are going to remember him for. Because I am an old timer, though, I still put his villainous role in From Russia with Love as big blonde robot death machine. Robert Shaw turns up, and he is the most sadistic torturer of James Bond in any of the Connery era villains. Telling poor Sean that the first shot won't kill him, nor the second, not until you come over and kiss my foot, and also taking brass knuckles to the solar plexus and not flinching. That's another great scene in that film. So I enjoy peak physique Robert Shaw in that film. But number one, hands down, is Doyle Lonergan in The Sting. He is a great foil for Newman and Redford, and just watching it for the card game alone is worth the entire price of admission for that movie. He's a great evil guy. You get this foreboding sense of terror from him. It's understated. He doesn't do anything that he doesn't have his henchmen do. He's not There's nothing physical about him. It's just his menace is pure. And I would put The Sting as my number one Robert Shaw film. Although I know many
Doesn't
opinions
surprise
vary on that.
me. I can't say that it surprised me that you picked that as that, because I have a hunch that you were toying with the idea of doing this thing as a group project at some point. I could be wrong.
Oh,
That was my guess.
it could happen. We'll have to see what this new year brings. I am a glutton for punishment, as you well know. So
Aren't we all?
things may occur. Yes.
Yeah, apparently. All right. So once again, we will play the daily game of Name That Remake. So I will spin the wheel and let's see what movie and its remake you get this time.
Oh dear. Okay.
Oh, you're gonna like this one. You're definitely gonna like this one.
Uh-oh.
Okay, so the original movie came out in 1960 and the remake came out in 1984, and it's about
I'm gonna say, but let me try. Psycho?
no
Ah, okay.
Psycho Psycho
So that
Psycho
would have been
was a movie made in
82.
1984. Psycho
Well,
Psycho
I'm thinking Psycho 2. I'm
No,
just
I'm talking about
I'm trying
remakes,
to
not sequels.
Okay.
Four female friends decide to take a trip while they are on a university break and go down to Florida. That's all I'm giving
Where the
you.
boys are?
Yeah.
Really? I was
Yeah.
wow.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. I did not That's another one I didn't know had been remade.
I'm actually
Holy
surprised about
smokes.
that.
I gotta catch up on movies.
I think you would have known about the one from the 80s as opposed to the one from 1960.
No, I think of I just think of a song.
Right. Well, obviously the remake from 1984 is very typical 80s sex comedy movie, as opposed to the different way that they made movies in the 60s.
Who was in the who was in the remake? I'm thinking
Lisa
about like,
Hartman, Lorna Luft, Wendy Schall, Lynn Holly Johnson. And it was directed by
Connie
I
Francis was,
Averback.
yeah. Oh, really? From F Troop. Holy smokes. Okay. Paul Apprentice and Connie Francis, and I can't remember.
Dolores Hart.
It wasn't Eva Marie's. It wasn't Eva Marie Saint. Who is the blonde? Who is the blonde?
You have Barbara Nichols, Paul Apprentice, Yvette Mimieux, and Dolores Hart.
Yvette Mimieux. That's right, Yvette Mimieux. She was in The Time Machine the same year.
Right. And you know who Dolores Hart is, don't you?
Dolores Hart. No.
She's the
I
nun.
probably.
She's the nun
Oh, okay.
who votes for the Oscars.
Right, that's right, that's right. She was Elvis's girlfriend. Yeah, Dolores. Okay, yeah, that's right. Okay, I didn't catch the name, but yeah,
She's the
I
only
remember
nun to be a voting member of the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences.
Wow.
She was supposed to marry Don Robinson, and when she was engaged to him, she decided to become a nun, which it doesn't say much for him if she ran
Yeah,
away to a nun.
her
Guess he
answer
used
was
to
none
remember
for
it.
me, thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Wow.
Interesting.
Where the boys are. Okay. I don't know if that's on my list of I got to go watch that movie again.
No, it's not on mine either.
I think the last time I saw it was about the time that Pelham 123 was made. I think it was a regular in the New York area on the 4:30 movie, Where the Boys Are. I think that was like Beach Blanket Bingo week. On the 4:30 movie.
Okay, makes sense. That makes sense. All right, so Jim, would you like to tell everyone where they can find Jim O'Kane?
Sure. Actually, if you'll hold on for another week, come and see us at our new podcast site. We're doing the 2011 film Captain America, the First Avenger, and that's on the Captain America Minute podcast. We've some really great guests coming on, including director Joe Johnston, who is joining us. Well, I won't tell you where he's on one of our first episodes. So check us out at capminute.com, capminute.com. And it's also available, well, probably wherever you're listening to Rob's podcast, we're probably somewhere alongside of it. So just type in Captain America Minute and hopefully we'll be on your radar.
All right, excellent. And while you're doing that, you can do a quick search, try and find me at just look for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to moviearoundminute@movierob.net. So until tomorrow, achoo!
Up, oh, 'cause it's untight.